big year, 2016. It was the time of the Battle for Mosul, which was one of the largest urban battles fought since World War II, the culmination of the war against Islamic State forces in northern Iraq, and the conflict resulted in the city and its population being destroyed, devastated. Ben McKelvey, in his new book, offers a compelling account of exactly what Australian troops did and how they helped defeat ISIS during the Battle for Mosul. But he also reveals a hell of a lot more than that. Ben, thanks for joining us.
Good evening, Philip.
How did you come to learn about Australia's paradoxical involvement in Mosul?
Well, I got a couple of starts with this book. I was working on a book previously about commandos who'd been operating in Afghanistan, men from the 2nd Commando Regiment. And while I was working on that book, those guys were available or unavailable depending on their deployment to Iraq. And I had understood that Australian Special Forces had been deployed into Iraq, but the stories that they were telling me didn't really comport with the things that I'd heard about what their involvement was. That sort of stayed in the back burner for a little while until after the commando came out and one of the operators came and contacted me and told me that he was involved in two of the most sort of crucial elements in Operation Okra, which was Australia's fight against Islamic State. He had been part of Phase Zero operations, which was insertion into areas where Islamic State was in predominant control. And then he was in the strike cell, which was the key component of the Battle of Mosul. He was there in Mosul with that team.
Ben, your story covers the conflict in both Iraq and Afghanistan, and you write that Afghanistan was a far bloodier and more confusing conflict than you'd imagined.
Yeah, it was. Afghanistan, there were myriad problems in Afghanistan, and one of which was that Australia was operating in an area with very porous borders. So regardless of Australian efforts, it was highly likely that they were not going to be able to pacify Uruzgan, which is where they were working. They did the best that they could, and one of the things that the Australian Special Forces were tasked with doing was finding the key Taliban who were involved in the area, bomb makers and people who were bringing in arms. And that was by way of capture-kill operations. So there was a lot of killing going on, and there was some effect, but they weren't going to get the total effect that they wanted. And as the war waned, I think the soldiers started to recognise that.
Your information suggests that roughly 10,000 Afghans were, quote, legally killed by Australian soldiers and ordnance.
Yes, that's right. There was an internal report that I was told that about 10,000 Afghans had been killed in gunfights and, strikes and bombings and things like that. And then I sat down with somebody else who was writing a book about Afghanistan, Chris Masters, and we sort of swapped notes and we surmised that it would be about 8 to 12,000 Afghans who'd been killed.
Neutralize, destroy, disrupt, army speak for killing, and we sometimes overlook that this is what these soldiers have been trained for and are willing, even eager participants. But, of course, it has profound emotional and mental health consequences.
No, of course, and that's something that you have to recognize and you have to remember. Our Australian forces and our Australian Special Forces are not in the business of losing gunfights, and it is not their obligation to be in a fair fight. They are there to win the gunfights. A lot of the gunfights they were involved in, especially in Afghanistan, were instigated by the Afghans. And once the fight happens, then somebody who's holding a radio and somebody who's holding a gun is going to be killed. But that is going to have an effect on our Special Forces warfighters, and that is something that's being felt now. It's sort of recognised that there's usually a lag of perhaps 5 or 6 years when PTSD really starts to take effect. And we rolled out of Afghanistan, the last rotation of the Special Forces Task Group was 2013, and so now I think we're really starting to see the effects of that.
Your story follows participants in two sides of the Mosul conflict, Australian Special Forces soldiers and ISS recruits from Sydney's western suburbs. Okay, let's begin with the Australians who became radicalised.
Yeah, they're really interesting characters in that I think some of these men may have ended up becoming violent, but they may have become violent in a criminal milieu previously. But Islamic State had created a framework in which these people could be monsters. One of the things that I'm holding a book right now, actually, which is about the jurisprudence of jihad that was published by Islamic State. And they had built this legal framework to allow these men to apply themselves to their basest instincts. Slavery was something that was employed in Islamic State. Some of the Australian men, like Khalid Sharouf, ended up executing a number of people, and they seemed to enjoy the depravity of that. There's a famous photograph of Khalid Sharouf with one of his sons holding severed heads in the Syrian city of Raqqa. I think that these guys would have had troubled lives anyway, but I don't think that they would have had these horrifically troubled lives that they did were it not for Islamic State.
Let's remind ourselves that Khalid Sharouf got 5 years finally, showed remorse, psychiatric report said he had mental illness, and after time and remand, he gets out 3 weeks later, a free man.
Yeah, he did. I spoke to one of the policemen who was involved in that case, and one of the guys who was running Operation Pendennis, which was the operation to shut down that attempted terrorist attack. And his thought was that at that point, Khalid Sharouf's trial had been put back because of these mental health issues that he undoubtedly was having. But they had already prosecuted some of the ringleaders. Khalid Sharouf had sort of proved himself to be relatively useless as a terrorist. He was arrested after shoplifting the batteries that they were trying to use for these bombs. The policeman I was talking to said that he thinks they just got to trial fatigue. And they let Khalid Sharouf get away. There's no suggestion that Khalid Sharouf really changed his ways ever.
Well, he leaves Australia to join ISIS.
He does. And not only did he join Islamic State, it seems that he was involved in some pretty bad gangland activities as well, and he was running away from a death mark. It looked like people were trying to kill him not because of his religious activities.
Ben, I want you to tell us about the nightclub bouncer who has the posthumous distinction of being the first ever Australian citizen targeted for death overseas by his own government.
Yeah, this man is named Muhammad Ali Barry Ali. There are a couple of reasons why I thought Barry Ali was a particularly interesting figure. You mentioned the fact that it's likely that he was targeted for death, and he may have been the first Australian who'd been killed by or with the help of the Australian government without any attempt at due process. But the other reason why I sort of found him very interesting is because I met Barry Ali a number of years ago. He was working as a bouncer at Love Machine in King's Cross, and I lived in an apartment across the road. And there was a busker that was across the road from our apartment, and he was sort of very loud late at night, and I had to go to work. And sometimes Barry Ali had sort of moved this man along, and, you know, I'd thank Barry Ali. He was someone that I would recognise when I'd see him on the street. And when I had heard that this is what had happened to Barry Ali, I was like, I was fascinated on the journey that he'd taken.
So tell me briefly about his journey.
Well, Muhammad Ali Barry Ali is someone who also had mental health issues. He had paranoia and he had depression. When he was in King's Cross, he was a drug abuser. And he, like Sharouf, purportedly had an epiphany about religion. And he, I think, like Sharouf, went over to Syria because he was an ego-driven man. He had a YouTube channel that was quite popular. He considered himself to be a pretty big man in his milieu. And the thing to do at the time was to go over to Syria and fight for Islamic State. Or initially he went over to fight for Jabhat al-Nusra. But Barry Ali was not like Sharouf and Elamar in that they were ducks to water in this jihadi fight. He really did not enjoy himself in Syria. And there's some quite famous tapes of him on the phone crying, talking to people about how difficult life is over there.
This is LNL on Radio National, and my guest is Ben McKelvey, author of Mosul, Australia's Secret War inside the ISIS caliphate. Okay, let's now focus on two special forces operators, Commander Ian Turner and Nathan Knox. What can you tell us about them and the role they played in the war against ISIS?
Well, they actually played quite different roles. Nathan Knox was the man that approached me initially and told me about these Phase Zero operations and the operations that he'd been involved in Mosul. Knox is a very sort of modern warfighter. He was someone that has an intelligence and electronics background. He was adept with working in the strike cell, and the strike cell was basically the coin of the realm in the fight against Islamic State. There were strike cells in Baghdad and Erbil, and then there ended up being strike cells in Mosul and in Anbar province. And the strike cells were basically these rooms in which there were a bunch of screens. They could bring drones into the battlefield. They could also direct all of the fighter bombers that were coming into the area, and they would build network diagrams of what the Islamic State resistance looked like. They would basically orchestrate the battle. And Knox was someone who was involved in those strike cells and played a crucial role. Ian Turner was more of an old school gunfighter. Like you mentioned, he was a team commander, and he ran a team in Afghanistan. He did multiple tours in Afghanistan, and he was one of the men in the stacks. So within the Special Forces, they call someone like Ian Turner a shooter or a gunfighter. So he was involved in a lot of gunfights, and his story is told. And the reason why I wanted to tell his story was because he was quite affected by post-traumatic stress disorder. And I had worked with him on one of my previous books, and then he took his own life in 2017, and I wanted to investigate that.
He committed suicide after being demoted for an incident or prank.
He did, yeah. It's something that in the book is described as the cock card scandal. Cock carding was something that that the Australian forces did pretty regularly in Afghanistan and Iraq. You know, they would find these pornographic playing cards and stick them on each other's backs, or put them in this instance, a stack of passports when they were coming into the country. And it seemed to be a relatively standard practice, but the acceptance of behaviours within the Special Forces had changed. They had a new CO, and then when they had found that Ian Turner had, you know, committed one of these cock carding incidents, he was taken out of Iraq and into a trial in Al Minhad, and that may have been one of the contributing factors that sort of, you know, triggered his mental spiral.
Now, Nathan Knox was involved in biometrically assessing casualties. He'd get fingerprints from dead fighters to determine identity and take them off the wanted list. And as you point out, the reality was that he went through truckloads of corpses most days, heavens above.
He did. And not only was it a case of taking these static corpses and, you know, fingerprinting them and checking their irises and other identifying aspects of their bodies. He did it with a partner force that was sent out to go and retrieve these bodies in areas where Islamic State was in predominant control. And the partner force were, they were often Iraqi police, but they were sometimes militia as well. And they didn't have the respect for dead combatants that the Australians may have. So there were incidents where hands and legs were being cut off and heads were being cut off and used as footballs. And his job was to basically maintain a relationship with these people, because that was the thing that had to be done. These were the people who were going outside of the wire and fighting ISIS to bring these bodies back.
Well, as Tony Abbott memorably said, shit happens. Now, in the aftermath of the conflicts, how did the Special Forces soldiers you spoke to feel about their service and treatment?
There seems to be a sort of bifurcated attitude. There is, as you would know, this war crimes investigation that's going on at the moment. And while most of the soldiers, you know, sort of wholly support the prosecution of the most egregious war crimes, most of the guys have been touched. So they sort of feel like there is this pressure on them, regardless of what they've done or what they haven't done. And so it's built up as quite a strange relationship between them and their service and them and their command. But there's also this sense of sort of pride, especially over the things that they did in Iraq, because, as you said before, Afghanistan was a very complicated war that ultimately you could say that Australia and the coalition forces lost. But the fight against Islamic State was a success. The territorial caliphate was destroyed. There aren't these terrorist attacks that are attempted around the world and these plots in Australia, not to the scale that there was previously before. So the guys feel very good about what they did in Iraq.
And in the few moments we've got left, let's remind ourselves about the nature of ISIS.
Yeah, well, I mean, ISIS was sort of a unique organization, despite the fact that it had metastasized from a group called Al-Qaeda in Iraq. They had these aspirations that were sort of over and above anything that any terrorist organization had previously. They really believed that they were going to bring on the apocalypse, not only to create this this proto-state, this theocracy in the Middle East, but to actually bring on the apocalypse and destroy the world. So this is something that the fighters seem to genuinely believe. So at the end of the Battle of Mosul, the soldiers, a lot of the fighters in Islamic State, did not have a desire to survive that battle. They thought that they were involved in an apocalyptic battle, and if they were killed, they were going to go to heaven. So the fighting just kept going and going and going until there just weren't any Islamic State fighters anymore. They were in an area that was smaller and smaller and smaller, and there were more concentrated Islamic State fighters, but they were not going to give up. And that's why the battle ended up being so brutal and so debilitating for the city.
Ben, a final question. What about the wives and kids of the Australian jihadists? There's about 40 women and children still stuck in camps. Should the kids be punished for the actions of their parents?
Well, absolutely not. I think that it is going to be very expensive and very difficult to bring all of these kids and these women home. But I think as a nation, we do have an obligation to do that. The kids are blameless, and some of the women that are in the camp as well did go over to Syria in 2011, 2012 before. They had an understanding of what was going to happen. You know, Islamic State was not something that anyone had heard of at that time. And I think that we are going to have to sift all this out. We're going to try and figure out whether the women and the surviving men have committed crimes, but I think we should probably do that in Australia.
Nathan Knox said to you, you'd be a psycho if you saw all the shit you saw and didn't end up with at least a little bit of PTSD. And I think you think that's right, don't you?
I do. His was a particularly interesting case because I was writing about Ian Turner posthumously, and clearly post-traumatic stress disorder had taken him over. But when I was with Ian, he was reluctant to tell me that he had PTSD. And when I was with Nathan, he claimed that he didn't have PTSD and he didn't have any of the effects of PTSD. But as we were working, you know, and as we sort of talked more and more about the things that he had seen, he did start to relent a little bit and talk about some of the effects that he'd felt.
Ben, I have to say, just reading your book's enough to give you PTSD, but thank you very much for coming on the program and congratulations on your efforts. This is Late Night Live on Radio National.